case for oral argument this morning would be Mark and Marilyn Long, appellants versus the state. This time is the appellee. We have for the appellants, Mr. Meyer Henry once again, and Mr. Healy and Mr. Meyer Henry, you are once again presenting, correct?
Correct.
And then for the appellee, we have Mr. Joel Engel and Mr. Gary Kimson, and this time, Mr. Engel, you'll be presenting, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And once again, a note for the record that we have Judge Barnett sitting for Justice Wilbur. With that, Mr. Meyer Henry, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mr. Counsel. This is a delightful little case for you because it's statutory instruction. We aren't going to be up here arguing facts or anything like that because I think the facts are very clear. This is the statutory construction of SDCO 5-2-18. It is a statute that, frankly, was passed and reauthorized because it adopts, as it clearly says, the Uniform Relocation Assistance and Real Property Acquisition Policies of 1970 as amended by the Surface Transportation and Uniform Relocation Assistance Act of 1987. It is a case of first impression before your honors. It's on whether attorney's fees are required by this statute for inverse condemnation cases. It is not like Rupert because this issue wasn't raised in Rupert. This comes about if Mr. Long and the other plaintiffs are successful. We ask Judge Rappel for attorney's fees, and she, based on the Rupert case, denied them. We are not here challenging the American rule. The American rule is live and well. What we're here is saying, as three other states have said, is that the state of South Dakota has authorized the trial court to and is required to follow the same policies of the federal government. We get there in this way without reading to your honors all of these statutes through 42 U.S.C. 4654C. And that statute requires the officer who gives the state of South Dakota federal money for any program to get assurances that the state or any sub-agency or anyone else using eminent domain power within the state of South Dakota will follow the federal policies. The clear and distinct federal policy is found in 49 CFR 24-107 that clearly says the federal policy is to pay the attorney's fees, engineering fees, and so forth of successful inverse condemnation litigants. To that, the state's response, and we all recognize that at least 65% of all the highway money is federal money. And in order to get that money, the federal government received assurances from the state that they would follow this act.
Do you have in the record evidence that Highway 11 was built with federal highway money? It seems obvious, but is it in the record?
I don't know that it's in the record. But I would urge that this court take the same approach as others. The assurance is that the state, in order to get any federal money, will have to follow, as far as real estate practices, these federal rules. If you go read the Code of Federal Regulations, Your Honor, you'll see that there's not just transportation funds. There's all kinds of other federal funds that are also underneath this. I mean, if I'd have brought, or if my plaintiffs would have brought something under some other federal grant money, sewer or something, might be involved. The answer is, if I understand what you're saying, no, there's no direct evidence that you can trace out of their pot of money here in Pier, of which at least 65% is federal, which dollar went to pay for what.
What would be the triggering event then, the construction of the road in 1949 or the flood?
No, the acceptance of federal funds each and every year.
So that basically becomes retroactive back to 1949 in regards to this road? I mean, this road's been there.
Are you talking about for attorney's fees?
Yes.
No, the case was tried last year.
Correct. But I'm trying to find out what the triggering event is. Is it construction of the highway or is it the flood?
Well, it's clearly the flood. I mean, here, the Federal Acquisition Act has to do with anything that becomes an inverse condemnation case is defined by state law. There's no doubt this is an inverse condemnation case. When they did the repair and the rebuilding and much of the facts that went on here, 65% of that, one way or another, was all federal funds because 65% of their budget is federal funds. And all of us here in this room, perhaps except my clients, understand that there's a strict hierarchy over at DOT and how they do things. But these other three state cases, and the reason there's only three state cases is I went through, and I don't vouch for its accuracy, but like 41 or 42 states by statute allow inverse condemnation fees. So there's very few litigation cases, and I've cited the ones that have decided, which is Kansas, West Virginia, and Nevada, that have said the state has to keep its word. And I wrote in my brief a case where South Dakota is familiar with, South Dakota versus Dole. This is simply another extension that if you're going to take the federal money, you have to follow the federal rules. And I would urge this court to interpret, just as West Virginia and Kansas and Nevada did, that SDCL 5218, which is a statute similar to many other states, says clearly that to the same extent and the same purposes as provided in the federal act and the federal policies, and the federal policy is they pay inverse condemnation fees. It will probably have a dichotomy because there could be some cases where there's inverse condemnation that perhaps the state could question. But clearly here, all federal funds, it's part of the deal. I mean, since this case started, and this case is going on its sixth year now, the state's received $1 billion in federal funds, $1 billion highway funds.
But isn't that a problem between the state and the federal government? I mean, the statute uses the word may. The statute says the state DOT may follow the federal.
Well,
if the state doesn't do it, I mean, it seems to me the consequence here is they'll lose federal funding.
Well, I could be flippant and say, is that what the court wants to drive? Is that we file an action in federal court and get the $1 billion back? No. Let me explain may. The federal law, 42 U.S.C. 4655, in part says, the head of a federal agency shall not approve any program unless he, the federal agent, he receives satisfactory assurances from such acquiring agency that. The acquiring agency here is the state. The legislature in this statute gave the authority to the head of the DOT to give assurances to the federal government that they would follow these policies. So the state is in effect arguing that we want the court to approve us breaking our word and not live up to the assurances that we will follow the federal act.
Well, the question really, though, is whether that May statute is an express authorization for attorney fees, which is the rule of law that is required under the American rule that we follow.
Correct. And this was precisely what three other courts of Supreme Courts have decided, that clearly that is the case. Clearly with the background, if you look at my chart, which I think is accurate, that we're in the very, very minority that have had to litigate this issue, that those very arguments were used, if you read the cases I've cited, in two of the three cases to say, well, it's mandatory or somehow you have to trace the money to this project and so forth. Those three courts held that clearly the state gave its word that it would follow these policies in order to get the federal money. And there are no cases on the other side. The states cited four cases that are the essence. One is Rupert, which, as I've said, it wasn't an issue in that case, so the trial judge didn't get the rule on it. No authority. The other one's Barron, and there, Circuit Judge Miller, sitting on the Supreme Court, recognized that 5218 recognized or adopted by reference the entirety of the Federal Real Policies Act, but that case is no support here because it's on an evidentiary matter. But it was recognized in that case. Barron actually is a case for the plaintiffs here because it recognized we did take in all of the policies of the federal court. So here it is very clear that the legislature accepted Congress's deal. We will give you assurance. We will follow all your policies and so forth in order to get federal money. I think it's that simple. It's for this court to read that statute and look at what other learned courts that do. The argument against it is not very strong. I mean, there's nothing that would seem to be against the policy of the state of South Dakota. The American rule says this court needs and judges need a clear legislative authorization. I urge you to look at the three other states. No state has said it does not.
The American rule requires express authorization.
Well, if you follow Sutherland's dictates, Justice Zinner, and you recognize, which I think is the law in South Dakota, this court has said, we recognize the reference of a federal law by reference. You've got to take all of the federal law. Now it's in state law, right? And if all of federal law is in state law, then I urge you, what could be more direct than the owner of real property shall be reimbursed for any reasonable expenses, including reasonable attorney's fees, appraisal, and engineering fees, which the owner actually incurred because of a condemnation proceeding, if, C, the court having jurisdiction renders a judgment in favor of the owner in an inverse condemnation proceeding, or the agency effects a settlement of such proceeding. That is the law of South Dakota now, by reference. If that's not a clear authorization, I don't know what you could get from the legislature. So if this court still recognizes the adoption of federal law by reference, and if you find that what I just read to you is the federal law, then the state of South Dakota statutorily, clearly, has awarded attorney's fees to successful inverse condemnation parties. That's it.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early.
Well, I used up some of it before I did.
Okay. Mr. Engel, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and counsel. Today I'll be arguing that the trial court's denial of attorney's fees was proper, and in support of that argument, I'll be discussing three main points. First, we know under Rupert that a statute needs to expressly authorize an award of attorney's fees. Second, 5218 does not expressly authorize attorney's fees against the state for inverse condemnation claims. And third, what I'll call the URA, the federal statute we've been talking about, only authorizes attorney's fees for federal takings in federal courts. It does not authorize condemnation fees in state courts for state claims. The starting point for this court's analysis should be Rupert. Yes, they were using a different statute, but it gives us the framework to say we need to apply the American rule. And under that rule, the other party, the prevailing party, may recover their fees only with an express authorization by statute.
Okay, but in Rupert, this issue wasn't raised, was it?
I agree, Your Honor. This precise issue was not raised. However, the argument was similar. The plaintiffs in Rupert were trying to ask the court to imply authorization for attorney's fees into 21-35-23. And the court said, we can't do that. There's two main principles. First, if you're relying on a statute, you need express authorization. And second, When you're awarding attorney's fees against the state, we recognize that implicates sovereign immunity, and any abrogation of that must also be expressed, not implied. It's a similar argument here. They're pointing to the URA and saying we should, and to 5218, to say this court should imply authorization, but those statutes do not expressly authorize those fees. And really, just a cursory review, as we've already talked about today, of 5218 shows it's not expressly there. There's no discussion of inverse condemnation. There's no reference to attorney's fees in 5218. A closer examination shows other flaws. The statute uses the word may twice. It does not use the words shall or must. A plain reading of the statute really tells us all we need to know. It says the state may provide relocation benefits and assistance to persons who are displaced as a result of the acquisition of land with federally assisted projects to the same extent and for the same purposes as provided for in the URA. So the plaintiff's primary argument is that 5218 takes the URA and incorporates it all by reference. And obviously we don't quibble that a state statute can incorporate by reference a previously existing federal statute. However, this court has already held that the URA did not have an effect on South Dakota's laws or constitution. And that was the issue this court faced in Rapid City versus Barron. There, the city brought suit to contemn land pursuant to a federally funded program. The trial court allowed the plaintiffs to put in evidence of what the prices neighboring landowners had gotten for their properties under the rationale that Section 4651 of the URA directed the court to consider and ensure that everyone was being treated consistently. This court rejected that argument and found that it found no compelling reason to hold that the URA, even when read in conjunction with 5218, in any manner modified South Dakota's constitution, statutes, or case law. The plaintiffs have attempted to minimize the importance of that case, but the fact that that was the single instance this court has faced the URA and the fact that the court found it did not have an effect on South Dakota law should not now be ignored by this court. Even if we accept for the sake of argument that 5218 takes the URA, incorporates every provision by reference, and makes up South Dakota law, the URA itself does not authorize attorney's fees against the state for state inverse condemnation cases. The URA is codified at Chapter 61 of Title 42, and we've talked about one or two sections of that act. If you read the entire chapter, you can find some general purposes of the act, specifically as found in Sections 4621 and 4651. And the main purpose of this act is to encourage and expedite the acquisition of real property by agreement and to avoid litigation. I agree that the most critical section for this court's analysis is Section 4654. And if we're going to take the plaintiff's argument seriously, it merits a very detailed study. Section 4654 discusses when litigation expenses may be awarded against the government. And subsection C of that provision is entitled Claims Against the United States. It permits reimbursement of litigation expenses in two scenarios. In proceedings brought pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1346A2 or 28 U.S.C. 1491. 28 U.S.C. 1346A2 gives federal district courts jurisdiction of claims against the United States for less than $10,000 arising from the Constitution, an act of Congress, or a contract with the United States. 28 U.S.C. 1491 grants the court a federal claims jurisdiction of all claims against the United States, regardless of amount, founded upon the Constitution, acts of Congress, or contracts with the United States. In other words, as the court in City of Austin versus Travis noted, Section 4654 provides no authority for attorney's fees and actions. Section 4654 only provides authority for actions against the federal government and federal takings claims brought either in federal district court or the Federal Court of Claims.
Counsel, what do you make of this letter from the Comptroller General that cited in Mr. Myra Henry's brief? It provides that pursuant to Section 305, provisions of Title III are mandatory to the extent practicable upon states as a condition to their receipt of federal financial assistance. This is that letter from the Comptroller General to the Honorable Gillespie.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that letter. I'd have to take a look at it to be able to actually answer your question, I think. I am familiar with the argument that there was a handout from the Department of Transportation talking about adopting the URA. And again, that's fine. Even if we accept their argument that the URA is now part and parcel of South Dakota law, there's only one provision of the URA that talks about attorney's fees for condemnation. That's 4654. What Mr. Meyer Henry is talking about with the broader language is a CFR. It's a federal regulation implemented under the federal act. But we have no statute adopting those federal regulations, and that's an important distinction. The plaintiffs, and I think every case they rely upon, all appear to recognize that 4654 is insufficient. And so they all turn to CFR 49 CFR 24.107. And really, that's just a restatement of 4654. But more importantly, even if the court said, actually, that's broader than 4654, that goes against any court for any claim, that would be an impermissible extension of the federal statute into a federal regulation as recognized by the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, in Ragsdale versus Wolverine Worldwide. In other words, an implementing regulation cannot provide greater rights or remedies than the enabling statute. And in sum, all the court really needs to do is read the plain language of the URA to see it does not expressly authorize fees in this case. To touch a little bit on the cases plaintiffs are relying upon here, there's a couple of them. They all do discuss interpretation of the URA, but there are fundamental differences between those cases and this case. And I'll go through them briefly. It's noted in our brief for the most part, but most importantly, first of all, is Kansas and the Bonanza case. Kansas implementing statute states that state agencies shall pay or reimburse property owners for necessary expenses as specified in Section 4654 of the URA. More importantly, though, Kansas expressly incorporated the federal regulations implemented under the URA. You'll see the same thing with Nevada, another statute that has mandatory language. And Nevada statute 342.105 provided that the state and its agencies shall comply with both the URA itself and the regulations adopted pursuant thereto. Same with Utah, that wasn't brought up in this discussion, and same with West Virginia. So there's a couple common themes with those cases. They all rely on 49 CFR 24.107, which we know doesn't apply here because we never adopted it by reference. They all have state statutes using mandatory or compulsory language like shall or must, and they all adopted federal regulations that were implemented under the URA. And really that brings us back to square one under Rupert. There's not a single applicable statute expressly authorizing the award of attorney's fees in this case. 5218 doesn't do it. The URA doesn't do it. Arguably, the federal regulations don't do it, but even if they do, those don't apply to this case. And in sum, there's simply no express authorization. The plaintiffs want this court to imply authority in several statutes, but that goes against the American rule and Rupert. And therefore, the state respectfully requests this court affirm the trial court's denial of attorney's fees.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. Mr. Meyer Henry, you have 10 minutes to rebuttal.
Briefly, I would refer the court to the case cited in our brief, which is the Independent Community Bankers versus State by and through Meyer Henry. It appears that's still good law, and that this court said that the South Dakota legislature may enact statutes, including statutory definitions, which are adopted by reference, and that statutes adopting laws or regulation of the federal government effective at the time of adoption are valid. SDCL 5-2-18 was one of a series of cases. Some people aren't old enough in the courtroom here to remember a big change in the funding of highways took place back in the 60s and 70s. And so my study of eminent domain law and of highway transportation law shows that statutes like 5218 were passed by many, many states to give assurance to the federal government that they would follow the policies of the federal government, including what we're talking about here today. I'm afraid the state's being penny-wise and pound-foolish in their endeavor to not follow what they promised to do. I'm not here with a dark cloud. I'm not a Chicken Little guy. But should there be a decision come out that somehow avoids what I think the clear interpretation and intent of what the legislature intended to do? I mean, 5218 is the intent to give the federal government the insurance they will follow the federal act and policies, a part of which are the Code of Federal Regulations. And that's what these other states have also found. This is a tempest in a teapot. It's almost as if the state says, well, if we win, what happens? Some federal bureaucrat says, wait a minute, you've revoked your assurance. Give us back the $300 million for last year and the year before and the year before, because evidently you didn't give us assurance. And the statute says they don't get the money until the federal government is assured by this state that they will follow the Federal Real Property Acquisitions Act. This was a new area. I must admit, I had one other case where we were successful in an inverse condemnation. I was like the Rupert lawyers. I hadn't read the law. The law here is clear from these other states. Our state intended to do so. I mean, we have a number of statutes that are federal statutes that were passed or told the state had to pass, and this court's construed them. We just had one out of Watertown. That's a federal act that all the states passed so that we could deny access to roadways and so forth. This is another one of these acts. And the arguments made by the state are not what the law of the state of South Dakota is. So I'll end with it is this court's duty, and I think it would be fun to be on the Supreme Court and declare what the legislature said, but clearly this is serious business. This isn't just about money for my clients. Sure, that's why I'm here. That's why I raised the issue, because I think the law is clear that the state agreed to pay inverse condemnation. They don't like it, but they did it. And so keep your word here. I mean, this is what the law says. So if they urge you and they get a majority on the court, then are we out of compliance? Are we out of compliance? I don't know. But clearly, as a citizen, I'd never bring a case that said that, because 65% of our highways are federal money. This state would stop without federal money. And that's why we give assurances. Remember how we handled Dole? Fight on, Attorney General Tellinghuset. But if we lose, immediately we'll pass what the feds want. It's one of the greatest statutes I've ever seen. And here, that's what happened here. Maybe nobody noticed it. If you ever have someone come to your door and knock on your door and say, we're going to take some land from you, the state, they're going to hand you a brochure. And I know it's part of the record. And that brochure says to the citizens, written by the state of South Dakota, that we adhere to the federal standards. I mean, we don't have a rule of law like the federal government that an administrative declaration carries great weight. But clearly, the bulletin, when they go out to condemn, says we're forced to follow the federal rules. And that's in their brochure that, again, is made up as required by the federal government to use federal funds to acquire easements and so forth. So whether we like it or not, the federal government jerks our chain often. They've done it here. The legislature wants the federal money. They have some duties. They're very minor. You're talking about a pittance compared to the billions we will receive in highway funds to not follow what the state's solemn word is, should you agree with our interpretation of 5218. So thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer-Henry. The court will be in recess till 11 o'clock when we have our rules hearing.